I think you take risks every time. Every in life, you take risks. When you drive a car, you're taking a risk. Okay, you take a plane, you're taking a risk. But you manage the risk. You manage the, you know, probabilities, outcomes, and then you take decisions. So I think whether it's enterprise or whether it's starting your own company, you're taking risks every day.
Welcome to the Indianness podcast. We bring you inspiring stories from leaders with Indian roots across business, healthcare, education, politics, and more. Hear how they broke barriers and are shaping the future one bold step at a time. Today on the Indianness podcast, we're joined by Saumitra Datta, a pioneering voice at the intersection of technology, innovation, and global leadership. As a founding co-editor of the Global Innovation Index and a trusted advisor to governments and Fortune 500 companies, he's helped shape how the world measures and nurtures innovation.
Saumitra, welcome to the Indianness podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Saumitra, we have a global audience, as I mentioned to you before. This is about your life journey, but also about lessons learned by you that can be applicable to them, what could be inspirational for them. So to learn all of those, we kind of have to go right to the beginning. So tell our listeners, where did this journey begin? Where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your parents.
Well, thank you and for asking. And in fact, childhood is always very formative for everyone, I think. And so it was for me too. I was lucky to be born in India, you know, in a family that was very open, very receptive to new ideas. At the same time, very disciplined. So my father, he's a medical doctor, and he spent most of his career in the Indian Air Force. And the Indian Air Force, as you know, the two things. The one is discipline becomes very important. So discipline is vital. And that's very important in life. I think for life success, discipline and some basic elements of discipline are important in everything that you do. And second is that we moved around a lot. So every 3 or 4 years, we would, you know, move to a different location. And that really gives you the adaptability. You know, you to sort of lift yourself up from a place, move to a new school, make new friends. And you know very well that in 3, 4, 5 years, you will once again move. So in some sense, you become more adaptive. You become more resilient in some sense in terms of maintaining your friendships. And you also, I think, become more richer in terms of experiences. So even though most of his postings were all inside India, but still the fact that you were so mobile actually helped. My mother was a homemaker, and she didn't really have a, you know, proper professional career, but of course she dedicated her life to myself and to my sister. And she's a wonderful mother. You know, I'm very lucky that both my parents are alive and they live in Goa right now. They're quite aged right now. But at the same time, she gave us a wonderful upbringing, you know, full of joy, full of warmth. And I must say that she's the one who actually distilled in us high expectations. So the high expectations was in terms of performance in the school, in terms of, you know, doing well in whatever you're trying to do. So I think those are the key elements. And I should not forget, of course, my sister, who's older than me. And today, in fact, the day we record this is a very important celebration in India, Bhaiya Dooj, of, you know, between a relationship and between a brother and a sister. So it's very appropriate that I acknowledge her, you know, influence in my life. She's older than me and always has been a very important guide and a very important friend, I think, to me in different occasions.
This issue of adaptability, as you said, people move around because you, as someone who has kind of lived in one place, I think it's got to be really hard, but obviously it's enriched you because you kind of have to make new friends, new schools, and sometimes that gets harder. Dad was a doctor and mom, I say, was a family maker, and she put high expectations. Do you think, is that a great thing to have high expectations?
I think it's, you know, somehow it's drilled into the DNA of many Indian parents and families. And I think it's important to have high expectations, even though you have to be always modest and not, you know, seeing that it distorts the amount of pressure it puts on your kids. So, of course, in terms of adaptability, you know, I didn't talk about my current family, which is also very important, in fact, probably the most important in my life, is my wife, you know, and she comes from Spain. And the fact that I could spend a lifetime, you know, we're celebrating 40 years being together recently, has given me tremendous amount of knowledge into a whole different culture. Different culture, a different way of perceiving things, and that adaptability that I learned in my early years in India have certainly helped me to adapt to environments both on a personal front and the family in Spain, but also I think in my career, which we'll probably at some point talk, as it took me to different countries around the world. I still remember distinctly, you know, one, maybe I was in eighth grade or something around that age, and once I fractured while running down in the school corridors, I fell and I fractured my right wrist. So I'm a right-hander, so essentially it meant that the exams that, you know, that period, I couldn't take them very well. And so I always come first in my class, and in that term, I did not come first. And I distinctly remember my mother getting upset with me because I didn't get to come first. And I told her, look, you know, my wrist is broken. I could not write as fast as I could, or I could not do the things as well as I could usually. But still remember that so many years later. So I think that expectation is something that was there from the start. I think to some degree, even though I may have tried not to push it too far, I have done the same to my daughter. So I have a daughter who's now, you know, living in Seattle and, you know, successful profession in her own right. But I think it's something that is passed on. So I cannot deny that, you know, it has an important influence in my own expectation of myself. Because what your parents expect from you, you not only pass it on to your children, but also you impose it on yourself. And it also has, I think, influenced probably some of my managerial leadership styles in which I expect of others. And I think one of the things I've had to learn over time is that I have to be more careful in not necessarily expecting the same high level of performance from everyone. To give you a simple example, you know, once one executive that I was working with gave me a very apt illustration of that. He talked about the fact that he was trying to motivate his executive assistant. And so I'm talking this story about 15, 20 years ago. So he said, you know, to the lady who was executive assistant, that why don't you read my emails so you actually understand what is happening and you can respond to some of them, you know? So he thought giving her more responsibility, should be actually be happy. The experiment lasted for some months, and then he said, okay, now that you know a lot about what is happening and you're deciding for me in some cases, why don't you come and join my meetings? That way you're fully briefed in terms of what the discussion is going. It'll help you to, you know, answer, respond more correctly. And he started noticing that the lady was getting progressively unhappy, was not getting motivated as what he was expecting or he thought the results would be. So a few months later, he sat down with her and actually asked the question, you know, what am I doing wrong out here? I'm trying to actually do something that's good for you, and I think that is good for us in our working relationship. What is happening? So the lady basically said, you know, that I'm very grateful that you're trying to make my life a better life, or professionally in the school, in the office, a better life. But really, I don't want to do all of this. If you want to actually make my life better, you know, give me flexible hours and some other benefits that you wanted for childcare. So it's a realization that not everyone actually may define success in the same way. So yes, we define success professionally in some way, but, you know, guess what? Other people around you may define success in other ways. And this ability to be able to discern the difference and to actually respect the fact that other people around you may define success for themselves in different ways, and thereby your expectations in terms of what you expect from them has to be modified accordingly, is, I think, very important. I give you the example from this executive, but I think it's very true for something that I have learned over time. something that I try hard. I must say I don't always succeed to do it for people around me. And this is something that I've tried to adjust even to situations in the work life and also in the personal home life, you know. So I have sometimes expectations from my daughter when she's a child, what to do or what not to do. Or from my wife in terms of, you know, certain aspects of how we might interact and, you know, and share things. And I think I have to be much more careful. So I think that degree of moderation or grading of setting expectation is something that I wish Indian parents in particular would do more carefully.
So maybe lower expectations, is that what you're saying?
Not lower, I think different. Different doesn't mean lower. So you have to appreciate the fact that there might be a child who maybe doesn't get 100 and 100 in math, but guess what, is a great musician. Okay, so maybe does well in something else. So I think, you know, the traditional view of just because you are good in science and you had a scientific career and you expect people around you to just excel in science is a very narrow definition. Or some people might just be happy leading happy lives, caring for their children, families. And this is true for many women. I've seen many women who are super bright, super qualified, and who actually get great pleasure from, you know, raising the kids and managing the families. And that is also work which has to be appreciated. It's like my mother. You know, my mother did not have a professionally successful life, but I think she had a great life being a homemaker and a family maker. So I think this notion that different people define success by different criteria is very important. And that's true both in the personal family environment and also true in the work environment, because you work with different groups of people. You know, and you work in a work environment, you hardly know the true person. Now, you see one facet of the person for the few hours that you work together. You often don't have a clue of what's happening in the person's life, you know, what's happening in the person's family situation, what's happening in the person's vocational or other kinds of, you know, interests they have. And I think to be able to appreciate the whole person is difficult. I'm not saying it's even possible always fully, but that might actually help you to better understand why some people might be different. So I think the tendency that we often have is to expect that people will be like us. So how we tend to set success for ourselves or performance criteria for ourselves, we expect that other people should adapt to the same criteria. Or other people will define success the same way. But that's not true. You know, so it takes some degree of maturity, it takes some years of experience, you know, some, you know, scars on your back to show that, you know, actually you learn that over time.
In work, and this is for folks who are dealing with different people, as you said, there are different people. And add the complexity of remote work to this also. Are you saying that we should, there are high standards you place on yourself. Let's say you're a high achiever, for example. You should expect mediocrity from others, and because you don't know what's going on in their lives, remote work, et cetera. What is the message you're giving?
You're assuming there's only one scale. And so, you know, on that scale, if it's not high, then basically you're mediocre or whatever. What I'm saying is there are multiple scales. And different people at different time evaluate success on different scales. Someone might be going through a personal difficult situation. And for them, the mental health at that moment is the most important criteria. So what is important as a leader, as a manager, is to be able to appreciate the multiple dimensions that actually affect people's lives. And then to be able to set your expectations in terms of what to expect from them accordingly. If a person's prime consideration is, you know, some personal issues, let's say there's a crisis in the family, putting pressure on that person to deliver on the professional side to the highest levels perhaps might be counterproductive, might exacerbate a negative situation. I'm not saying that this person should be allowed to perform on a mediocre basis for a long time, but that ability to be adaptive and say, okay, fine, you have a problem right now, we understand that, And so maybe on the work side, we reduce the pressure a little bit and we change what you have to do, give you more time to recover and to address the other dimensions. And then with the expectation that once that is sorted out, we hopefully come back to a good, you know, the balance that we agree with is the right balance. So I think it's that adaptability that I think is very important. It goes back to the lesson I talked about at the very start, you know, how you move from place to place, how you force it to be adaptive to different cultures and different environments. I think that notion of adaptability, I think, is very important. And I think we have to apply the adaptability also to setting expectations of people around us, whether it's in the family front or whether it's the professional front.
Is adaptability something you can learn?
I think you learn it by experiencing it more. That's the best learning school, because you're forced to learn something when you're put in a different situation. Maybe you haven't moved as much as I have, but you have moved from India to the US. That's what I assume. And I remember when I moved from India to the US as a student, the biggest learning I had was not necessarily about American culture. Of course, you learn about the US culture and the US roads and all that. The biggest learning, I think, looking back, was what I learned about myself. Because you start identifying how you are different and why you're different from others around you, right? So you see the differences. If you're living in India and everyone around you thinks more or less the same, then you know, you think you're pretty much, you know, what the common flow is. But you put yourself from India into the US, and then suddenly you realize that, guess what? You know, people think differently about the same situation for good reasons. And trying to understand the reasons why they think differently is a very important source of learning. You know, in the classrooms, I always tell students when I teach them or when I welcome them to a program that those moments of friction are very important moments of learning. Because when something doesn't seem right to you, when something doesn't seem the same as what you might have expected, you can either dismiss it and say, they're wrong, that's not right, I'm right, you know, I don't have anything to learn from that. Or you can actually ask questions and say, why is that person thinking differently? Why is that happening differently? And you can use that questioning why to at least learn, at the very least, why that is, you know, the case. And maybe if you're open enough to it and if you see reason behind it, to change your position. I think learning only happens when you not only understand, but also you are willing to change, if necessary, your own positions.
Let's just go back again. You were born in Chandigarh, right? Mm-hmm. How was, I mean, dad was a doctor, but then you moved from city to city to city. Are there friends that you built over a period of time that you are still in touch with?
Absolutely. Some of the best friends I have are from high school and from the various, you know, communities that I interact with as a child. Your childhood friends are the strongest friends because, you know, the earlier you form friends in life, the fewer conflicts you have with them, you know. Not conflicts in terms of you're not competing for the same resource, not competing for the same job, not competing with the same promotion. So I have seen in general that the friendships you form early in life are more truer, if I can use that word out there. They're less constrained by mutual conflicts, and they're more genuine in that sense. So yes, I am very lucky that, you know, I still have friends. Certainly technology has made it easier to stay in contact with them. Also, what happens is that, you know, you go through phases in life. So many of the friends I was in contact with for the first 20 years, then strangely, over the next 20 years, you decrease contact or you lose contact. You know, you're busy raising families, you're busy building careers, you're busy, you know, doing the various things you have to do. And the next 20 years, once again, you start rebuilding. And the next 20 years is, in our case at least, has coincided with the use of technology. Facebook and other kinds of technologies have really become successful. And second, I think you also had a phase of life and where kids have gone to university or kids have now grown up and so on. So you have more time to refocus on some of the elements in life which you probably didn't focus on before earlier.
One of the messages that you're giving to our listeners is don't plan out either yourself or your kids the four-year courses you're going to take. Explore, because as you said, you never know what could click.
Absolutely. So, you know, I often do this with executives. I do it in my own life. And you say, and maybe you can do this with your own life, Sanjay, too, is that you look back at your life at a certain point, let's say, you know, and you actually ask yourself, what were the decisive moments in my life? Because there's some decisive moments that change your life in one way or the other. And you actually ask the question, how many of those moments were planned and how many were unplanned? The general heuristic you'll probably come to is that 20% are planned and 80% unplanned. And the real issue is, what life is how you react to those 80% unplanned moments. You know, do you even identify? Do you even see it? And sometimes moments happen, you don't even see it. Do you see it? Do you actually have the courage to act? Because often you don't, you know, have the courage to act. You're scared or whatever happens. Do you have the guidance from a mentor, other people, to give you some suggestions? Because you don't have the answers yourself. So I think it is those moments of unplanned serendipity, which I think are very critical. And in life, I think that's what life is about. Life is never planned. You know, however best you want to control it, life is never fully planned. Maybe 20% is planned. And the rest 80% is pretty much, you know, you're part of the flow, you influence the flow to some degree, but at the same time, you're influenced by what happens around you. And how you react to that is, I think, the critical difference. And there are people who react to it better than others, and they are the ones that we might typically term are lucky, because things happen around you, and the question is, what's your attitude to them, how you react to them, and how do you leverage them for success, or defining success and whatever criteria you're actually trying to measure success by. So yeah, I do think a lot of life is unplanned, and we don't often teach students that effectively, because the general, you know, sort of message we give students is, you know, have your dream and pursue your dream, you know, work hard, and, you know, and God willing, you know, you'll reach your dream. And the reality actually out is that your dream changes with time. You know, what your dream was at 20 may not be a dream at 40 and may not be a dream at 60. And you have to be able to adapt. You know, adaptability comes back as the theme. But adapt in the face of uncertainty, you know.
What are the other big influences in the decisions that you took? And I also want to come back to this decision of going to Europe, that you ever live in a parallel universe as if you'd not gone to Europe too.
Yeah, so I have actually, you know, looking back, what I can see is that I've always taken some pretty bold decisions, sometimes going against my family's wishes. So that started actually in school itself. So my family's, all of them are medical doctors, with the exception of my mother. So there's a very strong implicit assumption I was growing up that I'd be a doctor myself. And I actually did get into, you know, the medical exams, also very competitive in India. I got into some of the best medical colleges in India too. And whatever reason, I got hooked by the fact that I had come in contact with a friend from my school and senior person who graduated. And, you know, when I was in the 12th grade, he came to school to say goodbye. You know, he had graduated from IITs and he's going to the U.S. for some higher studies. And that experience of talking to him sort of fascinated me. And I really felt that I would like to have the same experience, you know, to be able to go to the U.S. and do wonderful things. I didn't know much about the U.S. per se, but beyond the movies, because I didn't have any family in the U.S. I'd never been there. I knew that as a medical doctor, it would be harder to go as a U.S. because, you know, it's more complicated. I didn't have any families or whatever. I knew from engineering it's much easier. So actually, despite getting some of the best medical colleges, I chose engineering, which was a very different family sort of educational mode, because my people, no one in the family knew anything about engineering. And you might be surprised to even know that I was so much in the medical world that till my 11th grade, I didn't even know about IITs. I didn't even thought about that because, you know, it wasn't in my mental frame. So I chose engineering. And actually, it was a choice that my parents allowed me, but I knew that it wasn't their preferred choice. Their preferred choice would have been if I had stayed with medicine. The same thing happened choosing my wife. Same thing happened with moving to Europe. You know, my parents' preference at that moment in time was probably, you know, marry within the community, probably. Certainly not go to Europe, you know, going to a, you know, French-speaking country and France. You know, when I went to France, I didn't even speak a single word of French. I didn't know bonjour, bonsoir, nothing. I didn't know anything of the language. So it was a very, they thought I was completely taking the wrong decisions. So there were lots of moments where I must say that despite the fact that I grew up in a very disciplined family, looking back, I took decisions that were sometimes contrary to what my family would have expected. Like, even remember when we bought our first house in Fontainebleau, France, which is a beautiful home, I still have it. It was a large, old French home. And it was like 200 years old. And those days, it was a lot of money for me, pretty much. And all our savings were going into that. And we take a loan and all that for the buying the house. And my parents once again said, I'm like, what are you doing, you know, buying this 200-year-old home? Because in India, you know, you had a home which was recently built or, you know, at the most couple of decades old. And so it was like, you know, I was making this huge financial commitment for something that, again, they were not necessarily in favor with. So again, the reason I'm saying this is, I think at key moments in life, I took decisions which were sort of my decisions. I owned them. I think it's very strange. I didn't realize it that time, but now looking back, I think I must have had some inner strength to do that. Because on one hand, I was very much obedient, you know, dutiful, classical Indian son, doing well in studies and doing well in this. But at some key moments, I dictate decisions against sort of the traditional family expectation at that time. And my family was good enough to actually accept my decision. So they didn't say, okay, you know, just because you're doing this or doing that, you know, we don't love you as a son. So they were accepting to, you know, still love me as a son and to welcome me and everything. But I think this, actually, I'm quite, you know, I didn't plan it that way. I didn't, you know, if you had asked me back when I was 20 or 16, do you see yourself as someone who goes against the family thing? I would have said definitely no. Because I was, at least the perception I had of myself was someone who followed the, you know, the family expectation, the, you know, quite seriously. But looking back, actually, I must say that I've been surprised at how many times I have actually gone on my own and taken my own decisions in some key areas, yeah.
So for our listeners who are sometimes faced with those choices, how were you making those decisions? Was it gut? People, and I don't know what you define as gut, or were you doing, as an engineer, a classic analytical thought, whether to move to France or, you know, come to, you know, Berkeley, or some of those key decisions in your life? How were you making those decisions?
You know, I wish I could give you a simple answer. The answer is I can't give you a simple answer. Of course, each situation is different. And in the heat of it, you don't fully realize how you're doing it, because it's never a simple spreadsheet analysis. You know, think about, you know, choosing your partner or life partner. You know, you rarely do a spreadsheet analysis. You know, it's a lot of emotions, a lot of gut, a lot of different things that come into play. And sometimes it's a question of also, you know, intuitively that's the right thing to do. So I cannot give you a good answer for how I took decisions in each case. But what I can tell you is that I took it based on the best feeling I had at that moment. And in many cases, I only knew it was the right decision.
But that could be limited information too.
Limited information, exactly. Looking back at my own life, I feel I've also taken a lot of risks. You might think going to IIT is not a risk, okay? But in the context in which I grew up, it was a lot of risk. Leaving Berkeley, going to France was a lot of risk. So I've taken So I tell people nowadays when I have students, you know, and they ask me about their careers and so on, I tell them, take risks when you're young. You know, as you get older, it gets harder to take risks. I think one of the biggest regrets that I often see in executives talk about is they didn't take enough risks in the career. And I think what I have done, and I must tell you, looking back and thinking about it, it wasn't a conscious decision. I don't think I would define myself to be a risk taker up front. But now looking at my choices that I have made in life, I think I am a risk taker, you know, by most definitions, and I'm a risk taker. So I have actually taken risks in a number of ways. For example, my PhD was in computer science. And I did my PhD in AI, you know, so hot field right now after so many decades. And I left computer science to go into business as I followed my wife. I only applied to one place in France. That's it. In Europe. I didn't apply to 10 places. So because I was still uncertain in terms of what to do and what not to do, I applied to one place, I got the job, and I took it. It happened to be business school. I didn't choose to be in a business school. So when I joined a business school, I didn't know what a business school was. I knew a little bit. It could have gone wrong. But then I had a backup of coming back to the U.S. after 2 years.
You did?
I did. So I'd kept a safeguard of a job in GE that kept open for me. So there was a safety net, let's put it this way, that I had kept a safety net. But I took a risk with some safety nets. I didn't know what a career in a business school would look like. And back there, when I joined in 1990, technology was not seen as strategic in a business context. Today is very different. Today it's all about technology. But back in 1990, technology was seen as a back office support job somewhere in the background. Exactly. So it wasn't seen as something important. I remember that my colleagues in INSEAD, they used to ask me, like, you did computer science. What are you doing in a business school, you know? So I think there was a risk element in terms of not knowing exactly how things would pan out. But then the good thing is that, I stayed on for, and year after year, things became a little bit more clearer and better. And the most important thing, I was enjoying what I was doing. So I started to enjoy it. And you know, when you're in an institution that is growing and that is succeeding and that it's, becoming global, it gives you more opportunities to actually do exciting projects. So it was exciting to be there. But yeah, the honest answer is that I did not follow some of the same guidelines that today I would give. So today, from a more, planned perspective, I would, of course, tell people take risks, but, you know, of course, have mentors and have, you know, people who guide you, have data and make analysis and so on. I would tell them that. Yeah, today I would tell them that. But if I look at it in my own personal case, yes, I did consult other people, and I think the consultation of people has increased as I got older. But when I was 20, 22, I didn't have that many people to consult. And the people I was consulting mainly were my family, and I was going against them. So in some sense, I was choosing my... This is not something I did consciously that time, but now looking back, what I can see is that I must have had a very strong inner strength to actually go and take decisions which were quasi against what my family was recommending. Yeah. Now today, of course, you know, I have a wider set of pool of people, and I talk to people and everything else. So, you know, I always nowadays ask for advice. Like this morning, I had a breakfast with two colleagues. You know, one is 75, another is also late mid-70s. And I always ask them advice, you know, in terms of how should I look at, you know, the next phase of life and how should I do and so on and so forth. So I've become much more proactive right now in listening as compared to when I was, you know, 40 years ago. But I think I didn't probably follow the same steps and guidelines that I would give to others today.
Okay. So I want to pick up on two points here for our listeners. One, as you said, take risks when you are younger. Now let's put it in perspective of an enterprise. You're talking to a business leader or
right.
Whatever they are. They can't choose the moments of taking risks sometimes in their, because especially the world we are living in right now, major transformation is going on. Very major. You are, you know, a pioneer in that. What is the message to them when you say take risks when you're younger from an enterprise standpoint? And then I want to come to the role of mentors, because you touched upon that. You didn't have many early on. And this is also a message I want to understand from our listeners.
Yeah.
Let's peel a little bit in terms of taking risks.
I think you take risks every time. You know, in life, you take risks. When you drive a car, you're taking a risk. Okay, you take a plane, you're taking a risk. But you manage the risk. You manage the, you know, probabilities, outcomes, and then you take decisions. So I think whether it's enterprise or whether it's starting your own company, you're taking risks every day. Now, some of the risks, you understand the consequences, understand the factors reasonably well, or you feel them in your control, and you take the risk on a calculated basis. And I would say even enterprises, there's so many ways you can take risks. Often enterprises have new projects, new possibilities. You know, they want someone to go and set up an operation in country X. You can volunteer for that. They want someone who wants to start a new product line, you know, which can fail. There might be failure associated with that. So you can volunteer for these things. So I think the attitude towards risk inside corporations has become much more open. But still, I would say there is a fear of failure, which is there in many people's minds, especially Indians who have this cultural risk aversion to failure. Of course we have it, of course. It's something, when I say we, I'm talking about generation, let's say, that grew up at least partially in India, or who have parents in the US who grew up in India. And now if your parents grew up in the US and you're second and third generation, you know, American, then it's a different story, because you might have become culturally very American. But at least the people who have a strong either parent or direct themselves linked to Indian roots, I do think that is something which is an important issue. And I do think that encouraging people to take risks is very important. That doesn't mean do crazy things. And of course, you can extend risk-taking to doing crazy things and so on. But I do believe that everyone has a, you know, their own tolerance for risk. And you have to be aware of that. But in your own tolerance range, go towards the higher end. That's my point. Some people's tolerance is very high, and then they leave the enterprise and they start a venture. That's, you know, very high tolerance. Some people don't want to leave their own enterprise and they want to stay inside that. But inside that, they can still do interesting things. Even if you're an academic, you know, leader that I have been most of my life, you can start new projects, you can start new things. For example, I'll give you a real example. At Cornell, when I joined, I saw immediately coming outside that Cornell had four schools teaching business. I was the dean of the Johnson Graduate School of doing the MBA programs, but then the hotel school doing service management. There was an undergraduate economics program in the agriculture school, which had evolved into the undergraduate business program of the university. And then there was a school called ILR, which is the Industrial Labor Relations Program, which is really human resource management. And when I joined back in 2012, Cornell was not seen in the US as one of the big business school players. You know, you had Kellogg, you had Northwestern, you had UPenn, you had, you know, the big ones, Columbia and so on. But if you actually add these four schools in Cornell, Cornell is like the second or third largest in the country. So I could see it because I came from the outside. So that was helpful. Because when you're inside, you often, you know, think of the fish in the water. You don't actually notice the water that much. And I made a proposal to the university saying that you should merge these things. You'll get the power of the scale and the whole force of the business education inside the university. And I could convince the university to take the risk. Because to merge schools is a high-risk venture inside universities. It's much easier to start a new school than to try and merge existing schools, because you have so many complexities, the faculty, the students, the multiple layers of staff, and more important, the alumni. The alumni don't want to see the schools merged. They're very you know, obsessed about the identity of the schools. So I proposed that to the university. I'm very happy the university accepted, and I took the leadership to merge the schools into a new college. And today, that College of Business at Cornell is doing very well, is the third largest in the country, and now Cornell is seen as a major force in business in the country. So what I'm saying is, even in traditional conservative environments, you can take risks. And sometimes you have to convince people of your risk-taking, let's say, proposal, but you can do it. And this is what, for example, some companies like Google are very good at doing. You know, the Google, if you look at the most of the development side of Google, the way it works is that you don't have a job definition per se. You know, you have to define your own proposal, and you have to actually get resources for it, money and people. You go to pitch your own idea to people around you. And if you have a good idea, then people join you and people spend time, you know, giving you the assets that you need. So I think you can take risks in your own context, even in an enterprise setting. But you have to be able to want to do it.
Samantha, finally, when you look back at the 20-year-old you coming from, let's just say, IIT Delhi to Berkeley, what would be one or two pieces of advice that you think you would give, which would be helpful to our listeners, things they could, that Soumitra at that time probably didn't know?
You know, I didn't know, but actually looking back, I did, whether consciously or unconsciously, many of the things that I said I would do, I would give advice to do. So I ended up doing things that today, looking back, I would tell my younger self to do.
Okay.
But I would not know it consciously at that moment in time. So yes, definitely I would say, you know, be disciplined and work hard. There's no solution to that. There's no free rides in life. You know, unless you're very exceptional in some special privileged positions, there's no free rides. So you have to work hard, doesn't matter what. So you can't get over that. So keep on working hard is something I would have told my 20-year-old. I would tell my 20-year-old also is that see the world. I think the world is very big. And especially the world is, you know, so big, you can't see everything, but see the world with an open mind. And I feel I've been extremely privileged that I've been able to really experience the world in a pretty diverse way, you know. So my wife is European. I've lived and worked in Europe, lived and worked in the US and India. And also, interestingly, my research, you mentioned the research on technology innovation, they are about global pieces of work. So those research elements have actually brought me in contact with governments and companies around the world. Yeah. So I would say I have interacted with governments and with leaders and enterprises far more than what I've ever thought I would ever have done. So yeah, being more global in perspective would be very important. And also what I've said and what I tell young people is take risks, you know. And I think I've taken a lot of risks in my life. Not deliberately, I would not have said I was a risk taker then. But if I look at how I have evolved in terms of actual actions, I have taken a lot of risks. Not just in terms of things I've done, but also in terms of you know, we didn't talk about it. I've started companies, I have done things, and I've gone beyond my usual academic frame. Going into administration, you know, was a risk for my, you know, academic life when I did it at a young age in academia, starting companies, doing other things. So I always like to explore. And I think I would say, the final thing I would say is, you know, don't be content, you know. Of course, you've got to be content to be happy. And I don't mean in the way of being unhappy, but I'm just saying explore the world. And you only live once. Every exploration brings with it its own joy. Sometimes maybe some bad experiences, but on the whole, the good and the bad together make what life is today. So I think, you know, I would say explore with openness, with joy and learning attitude, you know, and balance, I think, the good and the bad, because life always brings both, and you don't get only one of the, you know, just good or just bad. So it brings both, and you have to be able to combine both and yet be, you know, feel happy and be purposeful. And of course, the final thing I would say is that you know, be extremely grateful for your family, you know, and try to preserve the family. And I see it even more today because I have two grandkids, and you know, they're the joy of my life completely. So I would give anything to spend more time with them. And I think that's something that, you know, gives you a sense of continuity in life. You see the next generation, you know, coming there, and you know, and you feel happy for them. You want to have a, create a better world for them.
So explore, be global, family. I mean, those are very, have a sense of gratitude, contentment.
Yeah.
I think those are great, great words. Towards the end, we do a lightning round of questions. So our podcast is called Indianness Podcast. Your very short definition of Indianness, what does that mean to you?
Indianness at its very heart, I think, is a willingness to really believe in yourself and the power of others around you to help make a better world. Really, that's, I think, what Indianness is about. Because we all are in India also very similar and very different at the same time. And we all have to work together.
You know, it's about giving back. It's also touching globally, but still staying true to your roots. Thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.